Ukrainian forces retake another town on the front line.
It's considered to be the key to a breakthrough by the Ukrainian armed forces on the right flank from the city of Bakhmut.
Plus, how one writer's friend helped him see the role of empathy in politics.
But he said, I want to go to Ukraine for no other purpose than to stand on Ukrainian soil and just declare my support for Ukraine and for what they're going through right now.
And later in the program, a look forward to the UN General Assembly meeting and what to do with seized Russian money. Ukrainian politicians have an idea. Today is Friday, September 15th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Coming up soon, the liberation of Andriivka. Now, a look ahead. The war in Ukraine is likely to be the big topic for a second year in a row when leaders gather at the UN General Assembly next week. But many developing countries are hoping to shine a light on issues important to them, including development, high inflation, and climate change. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashir has more.
This year's General Assembly is taking place after a marathon month of summits and meetings, and some high-profile leaders are skipping the annual gathering. But there will still be plenty to talk about, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
We'll be gathering at a time when humanity faces huge challenges, from the worsening climate emergency to escalating conflicts, the global cost of living crisis, soaring inequalities, and dramatic technological disruptions. And people are looking to their leaders for a way out of this mess.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to attend in person for the first time since Russia invaded his country in February 2022. It is an opportunity for him to appeal for international support, but he must also walk a diplomatic fine line. Richard Gallen is the director of UN Affairs for the International Crisis Group.
Zelensky does have to be conscious that there are a lot of leaders from developing countries who have problems of their own, such as debt and poor economic growth. And they want to talk about those topics and not just the war between Russia and Ukraine.
That includes sustainable development, which is off track for meeting 2030 targets to end hunger and extreme poverty. The Secretary General says there is space to discuss both the war in Ukraine and other pressing issues during the week.
I believe that there is room for all issues to be seriously discussed.
President Joe Biden will address the General Assembly on Tuesday morning, laying out U.S. priorities. With much on the line, the world's citizens will be looking to leaders to take action to improve their daily lives and safeguard their future. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
And following the UNGA in New York, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to visit Washington as Congress continues to debate $21 billion in additional aid to Ukraine to support its fight against Russia. U.S. lawmakers are increasingly divided over whether to provide Ukraine with more assistance as its battle continues. President Joe Biden is seeking $13 billion in military and $8 billion in humanitarian funding. But some Republican Party lawmakers oppose sending more aid to Ukraine. Ukrainian forces have recaptured the town of Andriivka near Bakhmut after intense battles with Russian troops. AP correspondent Charles Della Desma reports.
The village of Andriivka is about 6 miles south of the Russia-occupied town of Bakhmut in the eastern Donetsk region. It's the latest gain for Kyiv in a counter-offensive that's seen slow but steady gains by Ukrainian forces. The announcement of reclaiming the village came early Friday from the General Staff of Ukraine's Armed Forces. The 3rd Assault Brigade said its victory was secured after surrounding the Russian garrison in what it described as a lightning operation and destroying it over 2 days. Soldiers describe the capture as a breakthrough on the southern flank of Bakhmut and key to success in all further directions. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
We've just heard about the liberation of Andriivka from Charles de Ledesma. For more details and context, we turn to Kyiv and Anna Chernikova.
Yeah, actually, Ukrainian armed forces reported today, finally, it was officially confirmed by the general staff, and Ukrainian armed forces reported about the successful operation. It's pretty big success for Ukrainian armed forces, at least according to the report and to the analysis by the experts of this particular area, because the settlement of Andriivka is actually... it's considered to be the key to a breakthrough by the Ukrainian armed forces on the right flank from the city of Bakhmut. And Ukrainian armed forces are trying to get closer to Bakhmut. And it might be that they will kind of also try to surround and defeat Russian armed forces in Bakhmut the same way they did in Andriivka. At least this is how it looks, that Ukrainian forces are kind of getting close to Bakhmut from different directions and from different sides.
And how does Andriivka compare with Robotyne as strategic locations, as important places for Ukraine to hold on to?
Well, it could be slightly compared, I think. It's not correct to say that it has the same meaning, because the front line in Zaporizhia region is, at this point at least, looks bigger, and I mean, you know, getting closer to the occupied areas in the Zaporizhia region and in Kherson region, which Ukrainian forces are trying to do, is a little bit different from getting to Bakhmut. But I think that the meaning, the meaning is probably similar, because at least this is how it's perceived and presented by the military officials here in Kyiv. Because, you know, every successful operation and every liberation of every settlement, especially such strategic area, strategic settlements in terms of location, is always extremely important.
Now, Anna, I know that usually authorities don't comment on this, but is there any sense of the cost of the battle for Andriivka, for casualties, for equipment lost, things like that?
Manpower cost is extremely high. This is what was also confirmed and told by the soldiers who were involved in this operation, and they said in their comment that we have to understand what price Ukrainian soldiers are paying, and this price is the highest price, and unfortunately, this kind of also confirmation that loss of the Ukrainian manpower might be also quite high in that area. But again, we do not have any confirmation of numbers, but we understand that a lot of blood has been shed in that area.
And we'll leave it there for today. Anna Chernikova is in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine, Western countries have frozen approximately $350 billion worth of assets from the Russian central bank. Inside and outside Ukraine, people are demanding that those frozen funds go toward repairing the damage Russian forces inflicted on the country. Oleksiy Kovalenko has this story narrated for us today by Anna Rice.
Automobiles stalled on debris-littered roads, a damaged electrical grid, apartment buildings with burned-out black holes instead of windows. Russia's invasion has taken a heavy toll on Ukraine, and recovering and rebuilding from the ruins, according to the most recent estimate released in March by the World Bank, will cost over $410 billion. 7 months later, that number is likely higher, and will continue to rise as the war drags on. Ukrainian authorities want to see the bulk of that money come from the $350 billion in Russian central bank assets frozen in Western countries. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that will teach the Russians something about loss.
When the terrorist state loses its money, together with all the Russians whose collaboration with the Kremlin created the conditions for Russia's aggression, or who serve as a public cover-up for Russia's corrupt officials, then a very important goal will have been achieved. They'll see what loss feels like.
But getting at that money is problematic, because even though it's frozen, it still belongs to Moscow. Former U.S. diplomat Philip Zelikow is a history professor at the University of Virginia.
So notice that there is an obligation to respect the Russian property. It would violate international law to take it under a sanctions regime.
But Zelikow says a legal case for seizing the assets can be made based on Russia's violation of international law.
That's why you have to then say, yes, but we're entitled to violate international law towards Russia because of Russia's violation of international law beforehand.
Russian authorities have repeatedly stated that if the assets were confiscated, they would go to international court and sue Western countries for violations. But Yulia Zizkina, a legal advisor for the pro-Ukrainian organization Razem for Ukraine, says Russian chances of winning that case are slim.
The bigger question is if that suit would be successful and if Russia can win if it sues. And the answer there is either highly improbable or just a flat-out no.
The largest chunk of frozen Russian assets, some $220 billion, is inside the EU, according to estimates. One proposal would send the interest from those assets directly to Ukraine. But Zizkina says that just won't work.
For this proposal is insufficient because this would amount to only about $3 billion per year. That means it would take 124 years by that very conservative estimate to help rebuild Ukraine.
There are $58 billion worth of frozen Russian assets in the U.S. as well. In June, members of U.S. Congress introduced the so-called Repo Act, which would approve using those assets to aid Ukraine. For Alexei Kovalenko in Washington, NRI's VOA News.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Do political disagreements need to be nasty? As we heard earlier in the show, Volodymyr Zelensky is preparing to come to Washington, where support for Ukraine is dividing the Republican Party. We meet one man whose friend's commitment to Ukraine helped show him the place for empathy in political discourse. Gary Abernathy is a contributing columnist for The Washington Post.
I do think it's okay to fund Ukraine. But as I've said, I worry how deeply we end up getting into it with all the problems we have at home. It's a very difficult situation. It's the kind of debate we have, Steve, I think, any time we involve ourselves in foreign conflicts. The debate should be had. It's a healthy debate. But my column is about, you know, my difference of opinion that I have with a very dear, very close friend of mine who is, you know, much more emotionally invested in what we're doing in Ukraine and who took a journey to Ukraine to show his personal support for that and really leaves me in awe of him for his commitment to that.
Well, let's talk a bit about that. Can you tell us who Jim is?
Jim Nathanson is a person who's been a close friend of mine for about 25 years. We share most of our political beliefs. He's a longtime conservative Republican. He's a former director, political director of the Republican National Committee back in the 90s, and has been a consultant for conservative candidates and issues for most of his life. And that's who Jim is. And because of our shared political beliefs, and also just a camaraderie we've developed over the years, we've become very close friends.
And before the events of this story took place, how would you say Jim felt about American support for Ukraine?
Jim has always been he's all in. Let's put it that way. He thinks anything but boots on the ground. He thinks the United States in particular has a responsibility a special purpose in supporting Ukraine, leading the support for pushing back against Putin's invasion of Ukraine, for rallying the world against Putin and supporting Ukraine. And so back in January, we were having lunch one day, and he announced to me, you know, out of the blue, he kind of said, "I think I'm going to go to Ukraine," which began this journey of Jim planning that trip, but contacting travel agents, making arrangements. And again, let's point this out, Jim is 78 years old, about a decade older than me. And this was not a frivolous suggestion, but he said, "I want to go to Ukraine for no other purpose than to stand on Ukrainian soil and just declare my support for Ukraine and for what they're going through right now."
So for him, it's a real emotional issue. Do you know what might have sparked that?
Well, yes, in part. I described some of the differences between myself and Jim. Jim is an observant Jew, and I'm an evangelical Christian. It's just among part of our differences. And when a video circulated several months ago of the Ukrainian Army Choir at the ravines of Babyn Yar, which was a terrible killing field in World War II, part of the Holocaust, really, of what happened to the Jewish people, singing "Eli, Eli," on Holocaust Observance Day. And Jim was just very moved by that. He's made several trips to Israel, and he was just very moved by that. And that's one thing that I think prompted him to want to take this journey and to just make him feel a kinship, along with, as I mentioned in the column, just a general feeling that we all share of empathy with a vulnerable people when they're attacked by a stronger force.
I'm glad you brought up the word empathy. That's something I wanted to discuss with you. Jim's experience, it seems, brought that empathy out in you, because now you can look at the issue, the people, the situation in Ukraine differently than you were before.
Yeah, and I like to think I've always been an empathetic person and always am in all areas. But
I wasn't suggesting that you are
not. No, I know.
But you're bringing it to the debate.
Yeah, so exactly. So, just talking to him and watching him being driven by this, what was clearly almost a spiritual event happening in his life, as he just felt he needed to do this. I mentioned that about a year ago or so, Jim's wife passed away after a long battle with ovarian cancer, and ever since then, Jim's just been kind of restless and more focused on what's happening in Ukraine, more concerned about the Ukrainian people. And just felt he wanted to go. And again, Jim wasn't going to go, have a big impact on this war. He wasn't going to change the course of events necessarily. But he just felt compelled, Steve, to go stand on Ukrainian soil and declare, as he did in an email when he got there, "I'm here." And it was just so important. And it just inspired me. And whether it's Ukraine or some other issue in people's lives, to feel so moved to go do something that lets us declare whatever the issue may be, "I'm here," is just inspiring to me.
And let me ask, did it change your view?
I'm sure it's affected my view, as I wrote in the column. Just seeing someone so personally invested in this, I think that whatever it is in life, we in America sometimes, especially when we exist in our bubbles, we stake our ground and we say, you can't move me. And I believe this, and I believe that, whatever the issue may be, especially in this political environment we're living in. And so it's just a reminder to me to keep your eyes open, to be open to other experiences. And when you have, when you care about people, when you, when we care about each other, sometimes it's hard for us to understand things that, that we don't believe automatically. But we have, I think, a responsibility to say, you know, if somebody I care about, which should be a lot of people, you know, we care about each other, keep our minds open and our hearts open to other points of view. And to say, you know what, I should try to understand why this person cares so deeply about something. And in that understanding, or in that effort to understand, we come to a greater appreciation for each other, I think.
So it seems like if everybody had a friend like Jim, politics might be a little friendlier.
And I would say we probably all do have friends like Jim, you know, whatever that may be. Let's open our hearts and open our minds to being a little more empathetic to things that we don't understand, maybe naturally right off the bat.
Gary Abernathy is an American writer based in Ohio. His latest work appears in the Washington Post. Mr. Abernathy, thanks for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And finally today, as Russia closes in on the city of Kupiansk in the north and retreats from towns in the south, city workers take to their posts at a firehouse and post office near the front lines, but all hope to find safety away from the war. VOA's Heather Murdoch has the story.
On the ground floor of this firehouse, there is cause for celebration. The war isn't over, but it is moving away slowly, as Ukraine fights bitterly for every meter in this counteroffensive. There are only 6 to 7 bombings a day here in Velika Novosilka, former firefighters say, making the Ukrainian town safe enough for residents to envision a future. This is Andrei, a former firefighter who stays in the firehouse to take care of residents who cannot or will not leave town. He says Velika Novosilka is quieter now and peaceful enough for residents to leave the building from time to time. But while he is talking, outgoing artillery fire interrupts him. But about 6 hours' drive away, in the city of Kupiansk, on the other end of Ukraine's war zone, the battle is getting closer. At this post office, residents mail out their valuables as they prepare to evacuate. 64-year-old Nina drops off a package. She says the city might be bombed, so she's sending out her most important belongings to western Ukraine. Like many residents, she plans to leave soon. About a year ago, Ukraine recaptured Kupiansk after more than 6 months of Russian occupation. Russia appears to again have the city in its sights, and residents fear a full-on assault could be coming soon. In the meantime, postal workers deliver pensions issued for months in advance as the Ukrainian government anticipates being cut off from the city. And many families who remained through the last Russian occupation are now leaving. Postal workers say when their office closes, they will also flee. Svetlana Olyanikova manages the post office. She says workers will stay until the office closes, and then she, like others, is prepared to evacuate. And in Velika Novosilka, near the counteroffensive, despite the war moving away, locals are not coming back. Homes are destroyed, and many who braved the last battles remain buried in their gardens. But in the firehouse, the few remaining residents show off treasures they saved from the war and talk about building a museum one day when the war is over. A little less bombing gives them hope the town will come back, they say, and perhaps a reason to dance. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Velika Novosilka and Kupiansk, Ukraine.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media, be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
This is the voice of America, Washington, DC.